Company of One, episode number 26. Welcome to the show today. I am Dale Callahan, and I am your host. This 26th episode of Company of One, we bring to you this show about taking responsibility for your career. I was just recording a podcast or interviewing somebody for a podcast that will come out in the future, and she was talking about taking responsibility for your health care. That was Sally Murray with the Egoscue Clinic in Atlanta. That will probably come out as the next week's podcast if we can get all the editing done. But it intrigued me, that responsibility for your own health care, responsibility for your career. Boy, are we not short of responsibility and taking responsibility in our current culture and current society. We're kind of blaming everybody for everything. And if you feel like you're absent of that, that you don't do that, I bet you do. I know I do. And that you catch yourself blaming everything for various things that happen. Even when we're late, we blame the traffic. There's always times that we are just failing to take responsibility. And I think that's a wonderful way to look at things. Responsibility, as described many times before by many writers, is the ability to respond. And if you think of it that way, it's not responsibility. That sounds like discipline. That sounds like an ugly word. Who the heck wants to be disciplined or take responsibility? That's ugly. But the ability to respond to things, wow, that's really freeing. That's really, there's true opportunity in that. So that's going to be an interesting show, but that's what this show is about. This is a show about you taking responsibility of your career, and in particular, of your income. And gee, I think we all care about that. Today's show, what we're going to look at is a particular element of that responsibility, and we call it opportunity analysis. Weekly I'm approached by somebody, and it's oftentimes multiple times a week, but I'm approached by people who have an idea. I have an idea for a new business venture. I have an idea to make money. I have an idea for whatever. And we all have ideas, and some of these ideas are crazy. But how do you determine whether an idea is a true opportunity or not? And there's a difference between an idea and an opportunity. An idea could be a foolish assumption, and an opportunity can make you money. An opportunity can push you forward. An opportunity allows you to impact people for a profit. I'm personally looking for opportunity, but there are scientific, methodological ways to know the difference between an idea and an opportunity. How to do a quick analysis that doesn't require a CPA or an MBA or anything else. Do a quick analysis to determine which is which. We're going to get into that idea versus opportunity analysis in just a moment. But first, just want to invite anyone, if you're in the Columbus, Georgia area, I will be speaking this week, Thursday, as a matter of fact, a couple of days from now. That is, according to my calendar, September the 12th, Thursday at lunchtime for an afternoon event. I think they call this a symposium for the Project Management Institute of Columbus, Georgia. And it's their half-day training thing they do. Forgive me if you're a PMI expert for not knowing exactly what you call that, but I'm thinking it's called a symposium. We'll be talking about networking with the group and really showing them some how to open the doors. As a matter of fact, how to find opportunity, how to locate it by networking, and how to open the doors, whether it be for jobs or business opportunities. And we'll be actually showing them step by step how to do that. And then next week, on September 18th, which, if looking back at my calendar, is next Wednesday, I will be in Richmond, Virginia, talking again. There will be a Project Management Institute, or the PMI, and I believe this is going, it's not called the Richmond PMI, it's the Central Virginia Chapter of PMI, Project Management Institute, and we've been working with them to set up a speaking engagement. We'll be talking about, and I think we're doing their dinner meeting, and we'll be talking about the networking for introverts, and we'll be going through some similar steps, probably not as much detail as we're doing in Columbus. But I'm really grateful. The PMI groups, they're really kind of a great group of people to be talking to, because being that they're project managers, they're well organized. They're very well organized. And fortunately, the people that do alignments and some of the people on our staff that are our team that helps get me there and helps do stuff to get me at these speaking events. Between working with the PMI and the staff, everything is pretty much well known what you're going into, because they're not willy-nilly, you know. I speak to a lot of groups and I'll show up and they don't seem to know what they're doing or even why I'm there. And PMI, you don't have that issue. They know what they're doing. They're well planned, as they should be, because that's what they do for a living. They're project managers. So I'm looking forward to those meetings. There's other engagements that I'm not going to even try to remember here, but if you can go to my blog, on my website at dalecallahan.com, and it's /speaking, you can see speaking engagements that are upcoming and past speaking engagements. That's one of the things that's been somewhat amazing to me, and I'll say as you get in your career and you find some things really work for you, and some things don't work for you. One of the things that you really want to look for is, what are those things that you are have a natural affinity to do, that you seem like you're halfway decent at, and find more ways to get engaged in those. For me, that has been speaking. I'm always a little shocked that that's something that I seem decent at doing. It seems like it works. It seems when I go speak, it seems like that's something. I'm much better in front of an audience, oddly enough, than I am on sitting here, even doing a podcast or on a TVs or some of those things where you're getting interviewed. Those things are somewhat a bit more awkward. You know, even doing this, I get no feedback from you until later. You know, so it's kind of awkward to do these podcasts. Other friends of mine tell me the podcast is just so easy for them, and it's just so comfortable to do. So, you know, we all have our unique talents and our unique methods to share information, and we have unique abilities. That's part of what this podcast is about, is helping you search through to find those unique abilities and characteristics that help you to grow. For me, speaking has been one of them, and it's a blast to do it. So I thank those group guys in Richmond and Columbus, for Georgia, for having us, and we'll be reporting back on what happened there. And as I mentioned, next week, I think, if all works out well, the next week the podcast will be with Sally Murray at the Atlanta Egoscue Clinic. If you don't know what Egoscue is, if you have arthritis, if you have muscle pain, if you have migraine headaches that people have told you, you just got migraine headaches, or you know, you've got back pain, or you've got herniated disc, you got those kind of issues. And basically the doctors are telling you, well, we can do surgery, or you know, there's nothing to do. You know, you're here, take this painkiller for your headaches. Check out Egoscue. These guys are revolutionary in a lot of ways, and Sally will be telling her story. Now, the reason I invited Sally to be part of the podcast is not because of what Egoscue is, although it's interesting. It is because of Sally is one of these people who just loves what she's doing for a living. I really don't think she can comprehend fully what it's like to go to work and have the drudgery of the cubicle insanity. And I think you'll understand that when she interviews if you listen to the interview with her next week. But it's a very good interview. We did the interview today. We'll do whatever's got to be done to it and put it up next week. And I think it's a great opportunity. But you can go to, again, go to Egoscue. And Egoscue is E-G-O, like ego, and skew, S-C-U-E, egoscue.com. Great website, some really cool information, and I think if you suffer from any of those things, we did, oddly enough, we got into a lot of the healthcare aspects of it, and a lot of what they do, and a lot of how they help people. And so if that's anything you got, you'd want to listen in to what she talks about. She talks in great detail about that, as how it fits her calling. Now with that, let's get into the issue of how to tell if your idea is a true opportunity or a dud. So let me walk you through just some steps. And this is going to be, you can find the details in the notes I'm referring you to on the 28th on the blog at dalecallahan.com/26 will be the 26th episode, and you'll be able to find the show notes there, because I'm going to refer to them in fairly close detail here, as because they're already written up there in front of me. And this specific podcast is something that I do usually in the classes where I teach entrepreneurship and workshops where I do entrepreneurship. We go through this idea versus opportunity analysis. And it's an eye-opener for many people just to understand, how do you flesh out an idea? So let me start here. One thing that I find a lot of people struggle with is they have an idea. And they feel like that idea they have is magic. You know, that obviously it's going to make me a lot of money. And there are other people I know, and you may be one of these. As a matter of fact, I think this is very typical in the entrepreneurial setting, even if you're, you know, a corporate cubicle person that you've never actually acted on an idea. A lot of people have a lot of ideas, and people tell me all the time, I got, you know, so many ideas, I don't know what to do first. You know, that's actually fairly normal for entrepreneurs, that they got so many ideas and so many things to flesh out, there's no way to chase them all. And if you feel that way, that's, you're fairly normal. But the fact is, you cannot, in fact, chase them all. Okay, you cannot chase them all. But the difference between me and you and anybody else, and somebody who's more of the serial entrepreneur who tries ideas, which I guess I do. Maybe I shouldn't put myself in that category. But one thing you learn to do is you learn to quickly flesh out an idea to determine whether it has any meat, whether it has any legs, as you might say. Does this make sense? Is it worth pursuing? And that's what we're talking about here, because having a million ideas, fine, but determining what to pursue, that's what's critical. And that's what we're going to talk through right here. So let me give you a quick definition. An idea is a groundless supposition. You know, it's just, I come up with this idea and I have no grounds as to whether it will really work. I have no grounds to know if my customers will really buy it, to know if there are any customers. And this is a lot of times the crazy ideas. You know, I'm going to start, some friends of mine not long ago, they wanted to start a lawn care company, and they were going to do it with only green equipment. They were going to not use any gas-powered or electric-powered lawn care equipment. And they were going to go to homes in, I guess, green areas of town, if you will, that people that they thought might be environmentally conscious, and try to, you know, go in with these real mowers, these push mowers and hand-edge clippers, and charge a premium because they weren't using gas-powered stuff. Now, you know, on the surface, I bet in some areas of the country, some people might be doing that. On the surface, you know, it sounds like, well, that's intriguing. But you don't really know that it will work. So And that's kind of what, you know, that idea is you have it, you have some basis for when they brought it to me. They had some basis for it. There is a green movement going on. There are environmentally people that care more about the environment than, well, they care more about the environment than humans sometimes, you know. But is that idea really a business venture or not? Because they don't have any grounds to base it on. Now, an opportunity, once you've determined there's an opportunity, it has a potential to help you meet a goal. Now, that means the opportunity has legs. You've fleshed it out, and really it's up to you to make it meet the goal. And then here we're talking about a financial goal. An opportunity analysis, what I would call it, and we're also going to call it where's the other example here from Wade Myers? The addressable market. But opportunity analysis looks at the addressable market size, which we'll talk about what that means in a second. It's the process of determining if an idea is in fact an opportunity. In the world of venture capital, we would call this due diligence. And if you've ever done investing deals or looked at bank loans, I don't think the banks are going to use this term as much, but people will say, have you done your due diligence on this idea? Well, you know, that's a fancy word for have you done your homework? Have you looked at the numbers? Do you know what you're talking about? Is it truly a viable idea? Of course, your answer is always, of course I've done my due diligence. And any good venture capitalist will poke holes in that and tear you to shreds because there's something you haven't answered. But that's the idea here, is doing your homework. So let's go through the couple of steps here. And I'm going to say there's three critical steps on determining whether you have a true idea and a true opportunity or a true opportunity. And first, I try to get clear on the basics. What will you do? And then now put this on paper. And you know, you've probably familiar with writing a business plan. This is essentially what a business plan would address. I'm not talking about writing it out, but you can write it out on a piece of paper. It can be on a napkin. But you've got to be very clear in these basics. What will you do? You must be clear and concise. What will you and your business do, and who will you serve? Okay? In the lawn care company before, you know, it was we're going to provide lawn care services that are environmentally friendly. And they were a little more clear and concise in the fact that they said we're going to mow and hedge, you know, do the hedges and trim bushes and edge with the, you know, hand edgers and things like that. So it's lawn care services. So it was clear. It was fairly concise what they were doing. They're not going to clean gutters. They're not going to vacuum your house. They're not going to paint your house. And by the way, a lot of that sounds silly, but a lot of businesses, and especially in the IT world, people get a little bit, well, they just start trying to do everything. The classic IT example is we're going to repair computers, we're going to install networks, we're going to sell computers, we're going to, you know, we're going to get in security systems, we're going to do it all. You know, and that's usually a death nail for a business, is trying to do it all, especially a small business. So first, the first of the basics is what will you do? The second is who is the customer? And I like to look at this as, think of a list. Can I take a sheet of paper or a notebook? You know, the spiral-bound notebooks that we used to use in school, and you open them up, and you know they've got the ruled lines there. And think about, if I just had that spiral-bound notebook, let me write down the names of my potential customers. Now, literally, I want the names. Now, you know, if I'm doing lawn care like I just described, environmentally friendly lawn care, writing down each name, that's not possible. But could I find that name? That's what you're really thinking. Is it feasible for me to get the names of those people? For instance, on the lawn care, I'm probably not going to do but a certain number of zip codes, and I can rule out apartment complexes. And therefore, you know, with a little bit of homework, I can literally get the names and write them down in my spiral-bound notebook with my handy pen and paper. I don't want to do that, but you see the idea. I'm trying to see that I can conceivably get the names of the people. Now, for instance, if I was going to come up with a way or a tool, well, for instance, if I'm a Goscue and I'm looking to, I want to reach all the reachable market in the United States that has migraines. That's a little harder to come up with, you know, to get those. Could I conceivably get the names of the people, even in my zip code, that have migraines? Where are you going to get that data? You know, you can write everybody's name down in the zip code and just try to market to them. That's usually not very effective. You're not Coca-Cola. You don't have Coca-Cola's advertising budget. You know, and you're not going to be able to get the healthcare data from doctors because it's private. You know, so how are you going to go about getting that data? And that's kind of what you wanted to say. Who is the customer and how would you address them? How big is that market? That's the key. You know, so if I pick a zip code, I can measure how big that is. If I pick a zip code with people with yards that don't live in apartments, I can measure how big that is. If I pick out people who have migraines, I actually might be able to get a number. I might be able to get some national stats and figure, well, here's the population of the nation, here's the population of my city, and make some estimate, you know, that, you know, 10% of the population has migraines. So I could figure out in my city, in my state, in my zip code, or in the United States, how many people is that? Now, how am I going to get their names? How am I going to get in front of them? That's one thing. But who the customer, who is that list? How big is it? What is the pain that you're solving or you're helping them to relieve? That's your value proposition. You know, we're going to make you feel better and we're going to make your migraines go away. That's a value proposition. It's kind of hard for you to put a number on that value proposition because that's a healthcare type issue. I'm going to mow your yard, and you know, that may be a little hard to put a number on, except that there's a market, you're comparing it to other market prices for such. But what is that pain that you're relieving? That's the value proposition. And by the way, when you watch advertisement, look at the pain that they're relieving. You know, look at all the drug advertisements and the pain that they're supposedly relieving. That's usually supposed to be true pain that they're relieving. What's the market size of your segment? So as I segment down, you know, what's the market size of that segment? And that's my example there of, you know, looking at lawn care in my zip code is one thing. I can get the number of lawns. I can get the number of people who mow lawns. But how many care enough about the environment? That's a special segment of my lawn care industry. How many care enough about the environment that they're going to pay me extra to do it without gas-powered engines? That's a special segment of the population. And then what is your price point for what you're selling your services? Now, these are kind of the basic ideas, and some people, no, let me just be totally honest. Rarely do I find people who have all of these questions answered. I was approached by somebody today with an idea, and as I basically went down these first basic questions, who, you know, what are you going to do? Who are your customers? What's the pain you're relieving? What's the market size of your segment, and what's the price? And he was actually doing okay with what he would do, who the customer was, what's the pain he was relieving. You know, what's the value that he's providing? The market size, you know, he was rattling off billions, billion-dollar markets, you know, but after a little whittling down, you kind of got, so he wasn't very clear on that, and what his price point was, he wasn't very clear on that. I rarely find people who are clear on the basics. Now, this is even true in front of a venture capital presentation where companies are seasoned professionals. Usually, sometimes they don't even have the basics, but you got to get clear on the basics for your value proposition. The second thing you want to do on your value proposition is you want to, I'm looking here at my notes, I apologize, I'm looking here at my notes and my notes are wrong. So I'm going to ad lib here, but the second thing you want to do is you want to go talk to potential customers. Now, this is the death knell. Nobody does this. I'm always stunned at the number of people who don't go talk to customers or potential customers. And remember what a customer is. A customer is the person who's going to take their wallet out of their pocket to pay you money for what you're providing, your goods or your services. You absolutely, absolutely, absolutely must go talk to those people you're going to be serving. Who else is going to tell you whether your little basics here are of value or not? Who else? You know, what are you going to do? Because if you go find out who these customers are and you say, look, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to mow lawns and do this, and I'm going to do this in an environmentally friendly way. What do you think? Let them tell you. Let them laugh in your face. You're going to know whether you have a viable market if you do this. And as I've seen some business people say, you must talk to 100 potential customers. I don't know. You can use that number or not, but I think the more the merrier. So if you can get to 100, wonderful. If you can get to 1,000, even better. But you've got to go talk to customers. And what you'll find is if they're hungry for what you're offering, if they're enticed, if they're asking you when you can have it, if they're calling you, asking you about it, if they're giving you their email and say, please let me know when this is done, now you've got something. You don't want mild interest here. You don't want somebody who's like, well, you know, that might be, you know, if you get that done, come back and talk to me. I might be interested. You know, that's a no. You want to get a fairly serious commitment to where they are asking you when it will be ready. So you got to ask a customer. So first you get clear on the basics. Second, you ask a customer. Obviously, since I've left out that part, my three-part is a four-part. So I guess I can't count today. What do you think? But that's what you get for not reading your proper notes. The third thing you want to do is ask a woman. Now, that sounds a little sexist maybe, but you've got to go seek counsel from a woman. Now, when I first heard this, I thought it was a little crazy. We were sitting down with an angel capital investor that was looking to invest in our company. He was setting together a group of people to invest. And he was a wise older gentleman that had been a bank executive at one time in his life. And he just looked at me and there was a couple of us there, but he was looking at me and he was like, you know, the one thing you need to do is you need to flesh out whenever you hire somebody, you need to, somebody serious on your team, your wife needs to be there. And one of the guys said, well, yeah, my wife knows nothing about the business. She don't care anything about what we're doing. He's like, that's even better. He says, there's something, and this is how he said it. He said, I can't explain it. He says, but anytime we made major hires, I started bringing my wife, and we would make the guy and his wife, or if it was a woman, go with her husband. They would come to dinner with me and my wife. And my wife could care less about the business we were in, but she would walk away, and I would ask her what she thought. And if she said, I don't know, there's something I don't trust about him or her, he said the deal was off. It was a done deal. That subtle. Now you may be thinking, well, that's poppycock. Maybe it is. I don't know, but I've seen this over and over and over before. As a matter of fact, if you listen to Dave Ramsey, if you read any of his books, and I was in some small conference when he was testing his entree leadership stuff years ago, and we did it, and he was making the comment to, I don't know if he was making it to a couple of us as we were talking to him or as a whole, but he was talking about he always vets deals, even with his wife. And she'll be there at the deal, and if she smells, you know, if she don't like the smell of it, they kill the deal. Now, you can say that's crazy or not, but I've seen over and over people will say, every time I went against my spouse, her internal judgment, I failed. So now over and over and over, I see a lot of businessmen who do this, who will seek the counsel of their spouse. I can't explain it. There's some God-given ability that these women have to read truth and character that I don't have. Now, however, what if you're the woman doing the deal? And people are always asking me that. What if they were, the only thing I know to answer there, because I don't know that this is a good answer, quite frankly, but, you know, seek the counsel of other women who you trust, but who are not involved in the deal. You know, you got to get somebody who doesn't care about what you're doing, who doesn't care about the business you're in. This is kind of like to explain it to your grandma, and if she don't buy it, it doesn't make sense. So, seek the counsel of a woman. So that's not just my advice. If you want to call that sexist or something, then, be my guest. But I'll point you to many, many sources that would back that up. The fourth thing you want to do. Now, let's assume so far everything. You've kind of get everything put together. You got the basics. You've talked to some customers. Things kind of look good. You've sought the counsel of your spouse or some women, and you may not do all this in this order. I don't necessarily think the order is magical, and I think it's kind of whatever comes first, but you need to do all of these things. The fourth thing you need to do is do the math. And it may be the first thing, it may be the fourth thing, but of the four things you need to do is do the math. And I mean put numbers on paper and see if the idea makes sense. And here's what really kills the deal sometimes. And I've got some examples here at the notes at dellcallahan.com/26 on the show notes. First of all, you want to look at what's called the addressable market. And this is much back in the basics. What's the addressable market size? Let me define this in a little bit clearer way, or at least I think it's clear. The addressable market, and that's what we said before, it's the how big is your customer list, your potential customer list, how big is that group of people. What the addressable market is, the size of the market that cares enough about what you're selling to buy it from you or your competitor. Okay? Your addressable market is the size of the market that cares enough about what you are selling to buy from you or your competitor. Now, I hope that makes sense to you, that means these are people that are willing to spend money on your goods and services because they're buying them from you or somebody else. Now, I'll give you a poor example of this, and this was given to me, I think it was Wade Myers that I saw this from first time, of New Venture Lab, and we were at an entrepreneurial conference, and he was sharing it. And his New Venture Lab, he's a blogger or website. I believe New Venture Lab's out in Texas. But he was sharing, or somebody was sharing, this is kind of a classic example, but I'll give him credit for it. Assume you've developed a smartphone app and it will sell and you're going to sell it for 99 cents each, right? It sounds, it's an iPhone app, 99 cents, that sounds reasonable. So you're going to develop that. Now, there's about a billion, that's a billion with a B, 1 billion smartphones in service around the world. So this is how a lot of people do this math. If there's 99 cents per app and 1 billion, so it's 99 cents times 1 billion, so my revenue, my total sales is going to be $990 million. Wow, that's great. And I see business plans put together on this. Now, hopefully you see the flaw in that. For beginners, 1 billion smartphone owners do not care about your app. I don't care what app you have, even the Google apps, even Evernote, even the most popular apps like Maps. I still don't think everybody has it on their phone. So these are highly popular apps that go across many different domains. But if you build an app on exercise or fitness or weight loss, guess what? Only a certain segment of the population cares about your app, and then you have competitors. So that 1 billion market size gets whittled down and whittled down and whittled down. Okay, so this is poor logic. So let me give you all the poor examples. Let me give you a poor math example where people haven't thought through. This one does come. This, I think, was an example that Wade Myers told me that was somebody he had advised. A company selling software to PBS stations, public broadcasting, to television stations, and they're selling software to help manage their broadcasts. Now, if you know anything about PBS, there's only a limited number of PBS stations in the United States. And here's the data the guy came up with. The annual addressable market is 368 stations. Okay, now what I mean there is because they've built software for PBS stations, and it's unique to PBS what they were doing. There's only 368 PBS stations in the United States. So if everybody buys, there's 368 customers. All right, now let's carry this further, and I think pay attention to these numbers because the logic is right. The conclusion is wrong, but the logic is right. Now, how many, if you know anything about larger businesses or PBS stations or anything, you know that people don't generally like to change software packages. It's a pain. It costs time and effort and money and all kinds of grief to change from one software package to another. And this guy did his homework and realized that 5% switch software each year. So that's 5% of the 368. Okay, so that 368 number is much smaller now. Now there's $50,000 for each software install. So every time they install it, it's $50,000. Okay, so are you getting the idea? So I'm going to do some quick math here, and I'm not going to do it in my head, but 5% of the 368, let me try that math again, because, you know, I'm an engineer, and doing math just is not my thing. Okay, I've got 5% of the 368 is about 20 stations. That number still don't sound right. But anyway, it's about 20 stations. Well, I guess that's probably about right, about 400. Okay, 18.4. So we might could get 18 to 20 sales a year of the 5% to switch, times 50,000 each. Okay, you're seeing my logic here. 368 stations, of those, 18 a year are going to swap. If I can sell to all 18 of them, I have $50,000 each. So that's 18 times 50,000. I'm punching this in my calculator, something you should have done before you started this. That's $920,000. Okay, that's not bad. That's not bad revenue for a year. I mean, depending on your business, that's not bad. $920,000 a year. However, you have five competitors. So let's just assume you're equal to all the other competitors and you're not, you know, they're not eating your lunch or you're not eating theirs. But since you're new in the market, this is, you're probably not going to do that well. But let's just assume you're going to come in and you got a divide by five, or you got a 20% probability of getting one. So now you might take that $920,000, 20% of that is $184,000 annual revenue. Okay. Now, if you don't follow all of that, again, the particular numbers, and hey, by the way, I did my multiplication right because $184,000 is what I have written down here. The particular numbers are on the blog at dalecallahan.com/26, and I realize that's kind of, you know, it's not a lot of detail, but it's a lot of detail in audio. Now, the reason I point that out as poor math example, this particular, is I remember Wade saying this particular example where they were trying to raise venture capital. Now, I don't know if you know anything about venture capital, but there's no venture capitalist in his right mind that's going to invest money for potential $184,000 a year revenue. As a matter of fact, I think if I'm writing this software and my upside, if I do really, really well, and I think this is pretty well, I think this is doing well, is $184,000 a year. Now, if you can write this software yourself and you can support it yourself, and it's fairly easy to do, and you don't need any staff, and you're not going to have to fly around the country to sell it and install it. $184,000 might be reasonable. You know, hey, that's pretty good money, and especially if you can do this as well as do some other things in a business. But in this case, this guy was talking about this was a venture and they were going to have employees and things like this. Now, if you think about going in business and your potential is $184,000 a year, and you're going to incur employees and insurance and expenses and all these kind of things, you're basically talking about forming a company to be in poverty. Now, that's what these numbers mean to me. And that's what they meant to Wade, too. And I think he advised this guy against this deal. But you see how this is a perfect example of everything looks right. I've talked to some customers. Hey, this is a great idea. There's a need in the market for this software. And everything looks good until I start putting numbers on paper. And, you know, I'm thinking even at I think the original numbers they had on paper was the 920. But anyway, even at 184,000, that looks, you know, if you're sitting there and you're some software guy or gal making 60,000 a year, what, that sounds pretty cool. But not for a business. Not for a business that's going to incur real expenses. That's a dud. So you're seeing the logic. What we're talking about here, we could do all of these steps that I'm talking about. You know, going talking to customers, a little time consuming, talking to a spouse or some women, you know, could be time consuming maybe, but doing the rest of this can be pretty quick. There's a little bit of homework here that he had to do to find out 5% switched. There's a little bit of homework to find out this $50,000 for each install, but not that much. Now, let me give you one other example, and this is a lifestyle product. This is an example we actually use when we started the Ask Dr. Callahan company. As you may or may not have heard before, as we've talked a bit on the show, it's a homeschooling company. We were in the homeschooling market. We accidentally ended up in the homeschooling market. We found ourselves overwhelmed with teaching courses and homeschooling, and we basically were stuck we had lots of customer demand. So some of these other boxes were checked off real quickly. Teaching high school math in a domain where people homeschool, most of them forgot their high school math, don't want to revisit it. We're talking about moms and dads here. There was real pain. And we came along and we were really solving their pain. And this talking to the spouses and the women, they were actually the decision makers. So it was, you know, these conversations were ongoing for a 3-year period of time while I was doing other things, and we got caught up in this. And it grew so much and so rapidly, we had to look for a solution. And so our solution, and by the way, we were doing this in our basement, and we had multiple courses going on. And by the way, that's, if you want to talk about a losing financial proposition, try teaching school. That was truly a ministry opportunity. So we looked at it and said, what are we going to do? We have three options. Number one, we can dump the idea and just walk away and say, we're not doing this anymore. Number two, we can open a school and manage it. I dumped that idea before it even got out of our mouth good, but you know, that was an option. The number three option we could do, and by the way, anytime we try to make decisions, anytime, and I think, you know, I've learned this from many people that, you know, anytime you try to make a decision, look for three options. Have three things to choose from. So the third thing from us was we can record the courses and sell them. You know, we'll be a product producer instead of a service provider. In other words, we're going to record the DVD. We're going to put it on DVD, ship it out to moms all over the world, and they'll have homeschool. Actually, when we did it, we live in the state of Alabama. We thought we would be selling it to our friends in Alabama. That's what we thought. By the way, if you think your business idea is going to sell most of it to your neighbors, unless you are a local company or like a lawn care or something like that or a restaurant, you're probably wrong. Your neighbors, you know, the profit is not appreciated in their own land. You probably know where that comes from. So here's our analysis of the market. And again, this is on the blog, or this is on the thing at dalecallahan.com/26. What we looked at is the homeschool market size was about 2 million families. Now that data, there was reasonable reason to believe that data. 2 million families. Okay, that's families. So most of them had 2+ kids. Now we this didn't go into the math, but you know, so multiple children. The high school percentage we just figured out. This was a guess. We figured, you know, 2 million families. Let's assume that only 50% of these have kids in high school. Since we were talking about addressing a high school market, I said, okay, of the 2 million families in homeschool, let's assume 1 million of them only have younger kids. They're in first through K through six. Okay, so at this time, obviously they'll grow into the other, but let's just assume right at any one point in time, there's only 1 million families with high school kids. That's a guess again. Let's assume the dropout rate of high school of homeschoolers is 50%. Now, this is not, hey, drop out of school, but what happens in the homeschool market is a lot of parents will homeschool in the younger ages and to play sports or oftentimes because they're overwhelmed at the, you know, teaching high school math and literature and things like that, they will put them back in the public or private educational systems. So we call that dropping out of homeschool. No, they're not dropping out of school, but we assume that 50% of these families bailed on homeschooling and went back to some kind of school system. In other words, they weren't going to be customers of ours because they were getting their math somewhere else. So you see, out of the 2 million, we already cut that to 1 million. Now we've cut that to 500,000. And what I'm doing is I'm whittling down the addressable market. Then the percent of the market we expected to hit. Now, this is a key number that I think is really critical for you to think about. People will tell me, well, I think I could get about 10% of the market share. Baloney. Now, you might once you're in business and once you're established, but your first year, you're certainly not going to get that. You know, Microsoft, if your name is Microsoft or Apple or Google, or, you know, if your name is that big giant brand, you may be getting 20% of the market or something. Or, you know, you may be getting 50 or 60. But for the normal company, 10% is even wild. So what we assumed was 0.5% of the market. Now, there's several reasons we assume so low, but one is just we're just conservative. So if I do all the math on that, I knock it down from 2 million families to 1 million to 0.5 million, 0.05% or 0.5%, left us with 2,500 families left that were our addressable market. Now, I'm misusing the term addressable market here. Forgive me for that, but because really the 500,000 are our addressable market, but we're just assuming now our potential sales, 2,500 sales units. Our average price per unit was $200. People that buy from us, generally it's a $200 sale, and that's proven out. So if you do all the math there, our annual revenue in this particular product space would have been $500,000. Okay, now that's a real example, and that example there was really used to make a real decision. And what you have to look at here is this. Let's say you've done this thing, and the question I always tell people is after they're done with this opportunity analysis, and they've come down here and they've done everything else, and then they've done the math, you look at that revenue number, and you say, is that interesting to you? Because really, that's a personal call. If you're going back to the PBS example, you might have thought, wow, $184,000, if I could just pull that off, just me and had one employee, that's interesting to me. And that's fine. That's your call. If this is for $500,000 of revenue in a particular product space, is that interesting to you? You know, you may say absolutely or absolutely not. You know, and again, that's your call. And especially since this is a lifestyle business, it's definitely your call. And if this is a VC deal, not even close. You know, we could hit the VC deal probably in a homeschool market. We could do some things, and because it is a billion-dollar marketplace, but not this. But this example kind of shows you how you flesh out and say, is this interesting? I've seen people do this mathematical analysis and come out with a potential revenue of $20,000. You know, and they're like, well, I really like this idea. And they go back and they do the math and they twist some numbers, which is fine because all these are guesses, by the way. They're all going to be wrong. You know, you might end up with the same bottom line number, but generally your guesses are wrong. And you play with the numbers, and you see what you get, and does anything make sense? And this is really fairly basic business analysis. So let me just kind of go you back through this. You know, getting clear on the basics: what are you going to do? Who's your customer? What's the pain in the market? Second, you know, talking to your customers, talking to your potential customers. Third, asking some women, getting that counsel, getting that women's intuition to play for you, and character issue, character and the idea issue. And then the fourth thing is you do the math and you go through this, the valid part of what I'd call the opportunity analysis. Now, all of this together should really help you decide whether you've got something viable or not. Is this an idea or is this not? And hopefully, as you see, you can go through these things quickly. If you can't get to your customers quickly, if you can't get to anything quickly, but you can quickly run some math, or if you can quickly talk to customers, the whole idea is we all have lots of ideas. You want to rule out something that's a dud quick, right? That's really all we're trying to do, is I want to rule it out. And if the numbers are okay, the numbers are going to be wrong. But all I'm trying to do is say, I just want to run away from a bad deal. I see too many people spending years of their life on what they thought was a great idea, and they're actually living below national average in income, and they're entrepreneurs and business owners. You know, because they keep chasing after that, and they keep trying to run that business the same way, and it really wasn't that viable. It was not an opportunity in the first place. So I hope this helps you as you evaluate. You know, take a look at this. Send me some feedback. Try running numbers yourself. Hey, you know, even if you got something, some idea, try running some numbers and send me an email, and I'll help you run some numbers. You know, we get a lot of email, but who knows? I answer the stuff that I kind of think is fun, and this stuff is kind of fun. Actually, I answer all my emails. Sometimes it just takes me longer. I thank you for listening, for being part of this. Again, if you have anything that you want to that you need to ask or add, and most of you send email, and that's at dale@dalecallahan.com. You can hit me with Twitter. That's all on my blog at dalecallahan.com. But my Twitter handle is just Dale Callahan, or on Facebook at Dale Callahan. I get mostly stuff through Twitter and email. There's also something I don't get as much of, is the voicemail option right there on my blog. And I think somebody tried it from the iPhone the other day. If you go to my dalecallahan.com on the iPhone, and you can leave a voicemail message. I just like that app. It's very cool. You know, it sends you a voicemail via email, and it's just really a great way to. And if you're lazy like me and you just rather not type anything, it's a great way to do things. But, you know, any kind of questions you have, we're going to be doing something on the Egoscue, like I said, hopefully next week. If you have any questions, you know, that would be, you know, if you want to throw anything in there, let me know, and we can try to address those, you know, right before or right after our interview with Sally. If you want to get to this show is obviously on iTunes. Thank you for rating it, for sending me feedback, or many of you have sent feedback. Thank you for if you'll go rate it. Part of what we're trying to do here is you want to encourage other people. You want to help other people determine what's useful and helpful to them. Thank you so much for your time. You know, it's now up to you to do your own opportunity analysis. So let's go make it happen.